This is the Benson at 100, a podcast from the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. The Benson is one of the world's most storied libraries. During this, our centennial year, we explore the people, archives, and collections that built this library. Learn more at benson100.org. That's benson100.org. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to an episode of the Benson at 100. I'm Daniel Arbino, the head of collection development, and I'll be your host for today as we give Pilar a much-needed break. Joining me in the studio is Susan Kung, the manager of the Archive of Indigenous Languages of Latin America, or ILA as we affectionately call it. Susan has a PhD in linguistics, and we're also joined by Ryan Sullivan, another PhD in linguistics, and ILA's digital content curator. And I think those titles, ILA, that is, and your job titles give away what we are talking about today. But in the event that they don't, we'll be discussing Indigenous languages and two people who have dedicated their life to Indigenous language preservation and revitalization. So welcome, Susan and Ryan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll kick us off with a question. So for someone out there that doesn't know what ILA is, can you describe the archive and the work you do within it?
Sure. I'll give it a shot. So the Archive of the Indigenous Languages of Latin America is a digital repository that's dedicated to preserving indigenous linguistic cultural heritage of Latin America, as well as collections of research materials about these languages. ILA's website is available in both English and Spanish, and the website's the portal into the collections. Media files consist of audio and video recordings, photographs and images, and other text-based documents. But I want to throw this out there that there's a common misconception that indigenous languages of Latin America are dialects of Spanish or Portuguese. But this is definitely not the case. The indigenous peoples who lived in what are today known as the Americas were here for centuries before the Europeans arrived. So their languages were spoken here long before Spanish, Portuguese, English, and French, and the like were. There were thousands of different languages spoken in the Americas before the European colonization, and hundreds of them are still spoken today. But remember that Spanish, Portuguese, and English, or at least the way we speak it today, is really different from the way it was spoken 500 years ago. Those languages have evolved since then, and the indigenous languages have too. So the collections in ILA were created starting in the second half of the 20th century when audio and later video technology made widespread recording possible for the first time. ILA was first launched as an archive, as a digital repository, that is, in 2001, and the collections have been growing ever since, with new materials being added every month. And new materials that we get include both analog materials that we digitize and the born digital materials, too. So there's modern materials, 21st century materials, as well as 20th century materials. Many of these materials were created by researchers or by native speakers working in collaboration with researchers, and ILA welcomes any materials that are in or about indigenous languages of Latin America and that were produced by or in collaboration with native speakers of those languages, as well as native signers in the case of signed languages of the region.
We make efforts to seek out existing collections of these materials, especially older ones that are recorded on fragile analog media like the magnetic tape found in audio and video cassettes. We work with the owners to digitize the materials and add them to ILA. Since we operate on a non-custodial model where we put the digital copy of the media into ILA and return the originals to their owners, who have the option of donating them to ILA's parent institution, the Benson Latin American Collection, where they would be cataloged and available for in-person research. We also accept deposits of previously digitized and born digital materials. The materials that are archived represent a variety of genres, including stories, oral histories, conversations, political and ceremonial oratory, songs, chants, recipes, jokes, riddles, and grammatical elicitation. Some of the materials are transcribed, that is, written down in text-based files or in scanned notebook pages, and some are translated into English, Spanish, Portuguese, or French. Apart from audiovisual recordings, our collections also hold published and unpublished documents like dictionaries, grammars, field notes and journals, manuscripts, presentations, and data sets.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you mentioned it officially launched in 2001. But with any good collection, there's a really fun origin story to it. And I'm betting there might be one here. So how did it get started?
Well, Joel Scherzer, a now retired anthropology professor here at UT Austin, he was motivated to find a way for linguists and anthropologists to easily share their primary research data. That is, the recordings, the notes, the drawings, the photographs that they created and that they based their academic research on. While some of the data might eventually be donated to brick-and-mortar archives, like the Benson, for example, or the American Philosophical Society, those physical archives are not readily accessible to anyone who doesn't have the means to travel to that location and stay there for long enough to consult the physical materials. In the 1980s, some academic publications that were based on recordings of indigenous languages started producing companion cassette tapes of the recordings. And then in the 1990s, these gave way to companion CDs. But access was still limited to the people who could buy the books in the countries that they were published in. So in the 1990s, Scherzer realized that the internet was a way to democratize access to these recordings, as well as to provide access to many more recordings beyond just the ones that had been used in specific analyses.
And in 1999, Scherzer spoke to a program officer at the National Endowment for the Humanities, who advised him to partner with UT Libraries, which he said had one of the best digital library divisions in the country at that time. So Scherzer then, along with Anthony Woodbury, a UT linguistics professor, teamed up with Mark McFarland, then director of the Digital Library Services Division at UT Libraries, to build a pilot site, which was launched in early 2001. That pilot site allowed them to get a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to build the permanent site, which launched in early 2003.
Because ILA's catalog and the digital files are available online, anyone can find them and access them, regardless of who they are. Academics, students in primary and secondary education, members of the general public, and language speakers and signers themselves, as well as their descendants.
That's incredible. And so approximately how many languages would these types of people, anyone, how many languages could they access in the digital archive?
There are about 400 indigenous Latin American languages found in our repository. This is about 70% of all indigenous languages that we know about from the Rio Bravo to Tierra del Fuego. Of course, some of these languages appear in only a very small amount of media, but our holdings for some of these languages are very extensive. There are 142 languages with over 10 hours of audiovisual content in ILA, and 31 have over 100 hours of audio or video.
Wow. And so what are some of the strengths of the archive?
A major strength of the archive is that the vast majority of the materials represent natural forms of discourse or naturally occurring speech, such as conversations that capture how real people speak and use their languages, much better than extremely edited published materials do. Another strength is that ILA contains recordings in languages that are not represented elsewhere. In some cases, ILA has the only known publicly available recordings of certain languages.
Because so many languages are represented in ILA, the archive can put people in touch with their pasts or their distant relatives. If they live far away from their homelands, they can hear voices of their friends and family in ILA. If their language is no longer widely used, they can hear it in ILA. If they want to find recordings of ceremonies that are no longer performed, or stories that are no longer told, or songs that are no longer sung, they might find them in ILA.
Yeah, it's really amazing work that you're doing because you are preserving aspects of a community here. Are there collections that stand out within ILA, and would it be possible to listen to a sample?
Yes. People always ask us if any of the languages represented in the archive are extinct. Now, there are languages in ILA that currently have no fluent speakers or whose last known speaker has passed away in living memory. But as long as there is some record of the language and a community that identifies with the language, the possibility for revitalization and reclamation of that language exists. So many linguists, following the lead of Indigenous American linguists and language activists, prefer to use the term sleeping instead of extinct for these languages. Now, that said, there are several examples of sleeping languages in Isla. Of the sleeping languages in Isla, Cacaopera, a language of El Salvador, has been sleeping the longest. When this clip we're about to hear was recorded in 1973, no one alive was considered a fluent speaker. Pascual Cortés, who provides the Cacaopera equivalents of the Spanish words offered by researcher Lyle Campbell, learned what Cacaopera he knew from one of his grandparents.
So, Cacaopera. Con Don Pascual Cortés.
Ah, como no.
Se dice gato.
Mi chingo.
Otra vez.
Es decir, mi chingo.
Ajá. Caballo.
Caballo de rey.
Otra vez.
De rey.
Tonco.
Tonco.
La vaca.
La vaca, sí. Ganas.
Otra vez.
Ganas.
Gallina.
No, eso no me parece.
Tato.
Tampoco.
Perro.
Es decir, aluscam.
Otra vez.
Aluscam.
Coyote.
No, eso tampoco, no. Guasala.
Otra vez.
Guasala.
¿Y qué quiere decir?
Es que ese idioma es el guasala.
Guasala.
Sí, guasala.
Animal
de idioma. Sí, ya en idioma se llama guasala.
The language in Isla which most recently went to sleep is Yamana, also known as Yagan, a language of far southern Chile. Cristina Calderon, who was recognized as the last fluent native speaker of this language, passed away in February 2022. In this clip, you'll hear Cristina and her sister, Ursula, offering Yamana translations of Spanish sentences. Another example is Cholón, a language that was spoken in Peru up until the turn of the century. One recent Isla collection features recordings of Marta Perez Valderrama reading and speaking Cholón, making use of written notes she made to remember the language. This is a notable case of a heritage speaker working to create a lasting record of their language. Here, Perez Valderrama will teach us a phrase in her language.
¿Y tú de dónde eres? Mi ajo indo de Bang Muktan. Ok, Shiyun tu Aktan. Yo soy de Sion, señor.
Now we're going to leave the sleeping languages behind and move on to whistled speech, which is a speech surrogate or substitute that maps onto spoken language. It's used to communicate across distances where voices don't or can't carry, like across a valley or a river. Whistled speech is an example of a linguistic practice that is more endangered than the language itself. So here's a warning. If you are listening through earbuds or have a dog in the room, we have one whistling mashup track to play for you now.
Chinanteco. Tepewa. Nahuatl. Tzeltal. Zapoteco.
All of these examples are from languages spoken in Mexico, but the phenomenon of whistled speech is found all over the world, and we've linked an article about it in the show notes.
We're also happy to have a few indigenous-led research collections, such as the Oxlahuch Kech Maya Achtzib Mayan Languages Collection. These materials were gathered by an organization commonly known as OCMA, which was a Mayan indigenous-led organization for linguistic research on the Mayan languages of Guatemala. Here, Miguel Paulino Cañac relates a story in his native Che Maya. Let's try to figure out what he's describing.
Gol, 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 gol.
Another example is the Chol collection of Juan Jesus Vasquez Alvarez and Jessica Kuhn. This collection is a product of a collaboration between an indigenous reacher, Juan Jesus Vasquez, and a non-indigenous researcher, Jessica Kuhn, to study the Mayan language Chol. They trained Chol people in data collection and interviewing techniques to build out the collection. Here, we'll hear Vasquez interview Marcelina Lopez in the evening, as you can tell from the crickets.
Two of the collections in Isla are award winners. They were nominated for and won the Sila Archiving Award, which is given annually by the Society for the Study of the Indigenous Languages of the Americas. One of these award-winning collections is the Chol collection of Vasquez and Kuhn that we just heard about. The other one is Isla's founding collection, created by Isla's founder, Joel Scherzer. We'll let Joel introduce this clip from Aguna Village in Panama in 1970.
Chief Moristo tells the Agouti story.
Teito Armando, ta cargo an marguendo visito erga vea, cuento. Us cuento masun. Ta cargo a ustega. Achu ebogua, pengo socarsun. Achu de us ebogua, usu, us yardakea. Achu so edit. Taidabsun doa, ta cargo us canna reguesi. Kir dakar sun doachu, palimai desun, palimatku, huevas oisunda navir soy, dakar guzu mas kunsi.
Really wonderful clips, super informative. I mean, for an episode dedicated to language and language production, I'm left almost without words. But fortunately, I do have some more questions in mind, one of them being, what sort of challenges do you face when working with indigenous languages that the general public might not anticipate?
Well, access to the internet is a prerequisite for access to Isla. I mean, while there have been great advances in internet connectivity in the past 20 years, there are still some places in the Americas without any internet access or without bandwidth sufficient to view or download the files in our collections. Also, a very large portion of our recordings are not transcribed and are not translated. Transcriptions and translations greatly increase the accessibility of materials like ours, which are predominantly audiovisual materials in languages that are not widely used. However, it's very difficult to transcribe and translate most indigenous Latin American languages since there are relatively few digital tools and language models for things like optical character recognition, automatic speech recognition, and machine translation, which can speed up the process. There's been a lot of effort into developing techniques and language models to assist with efforts like these, but for the most part, these efforts must be done language by language, so progress is slower than we may hope for.
An ethical challenge that Isla has juggled since its founding is the tension between intellectual property law and indigenous data sovereignty. The problem is that intellectual property laws and treaties do not adequately protect indigenous traditional or cultural knowledge. Copyright laws place a lot of indigenous knowledge into the public domain, and when this happens, indigenous peoples lose control both economically and intellectually of their linguistic and cultural heritage. Because Isla is a non-custodial archive, the people who created the materials retain all of their intellectual and cultural rights. They do not deed or sign them over to Isla or the University of Texas at Austin, but they're not open access under the broadest definition of open access. The broadest definition of open access basically says that anyone can do whatever they want with OA resources, but that's not the case for Isla. These materials are publicly accessible to people who use Isla, but Isla users cannot or should not do whatever they want with them. Materials should be used respectfully and in accordance with copyright laws in the countries where they are being used.
Can you talk about the outreach work you're doing with indigenous communities?
Yeah, so Isla has an almost hemispheric scope, and the vast majority of the collections originate outside the U.S. which can make planning outreach difficult. It's also really difficult to do outreach to Latin American indigenous communities when we are operating in a publicly funded U.S. institution. Many funding opportunities are limited in scope and exclude outreach work that we would want to do in Latin America. This is why we rely so heavily on the intermediaries, the people who are responsible for collecting the materials in the first place. Also, the pandemic prevented us from doing planned activities in 2020 and 2021, and also kept us from planning any new ones. But we have been able to work more directly with some indigenous communities. Recently, an Isla depositor introduced us to an indigenous organization that they have been working with, and we've begun collaborating with them to archive some of their materials with us. And given the recent expansion and normalization of video conferencing software, we've been able to have virtual meetings directly with the members of the indigenous organization, which is more direct interaction than was the norm even a few years ago, when all of our communication would have been mediated by the depositors, who are typically not part of the indigenous communities in question.
Most of our outreach has been to the community of practice, that is the language documentation community. And to this end, we created an open educational resource called Archiving for the Future, Simple Steps for Archiving Language Documentation Collections. This is a training course designed to teach language documenters, activists, and researchers how to organize, arrange, and archive language documentation and associated metadata. The course has been used by community-based language documentation projects, language archivists, and in language documentation methodology classes for both undergraduate and graduate students in the U.S., Canada, Europe, Mexico, and India, or at least that's all we know about so far.
That's fantastic. It's great to see that scope expanding and your reach expanding into other, even other continents, right? And so with that in mind, how would you like the archive to grow in the future?
We really would love to see more collaborations, more collections created and stewarded by indigenous communities and researchers. And to that same end, we would love to collaborate more with the indigenous communities and researchers directly. At the moment, we collaborate with communities who contact us, but we haven't had the resources to contact specific communities directly, and we would love to be able to seek communities out that would like to work directly with us.
We'd like to add a Portuguese interface to our website's current English and Spanish interfaces and metadata. Portuguese is among the most common languages used to access our site, and about every 10th collection in our repository focuses on one or more indigenous communities of Brazil, who are, of course, more likely to speak and read Portuguese than English or Spanish.
Of course, yes. It's a major language. Someday we'll have to have a podcast in Portuguese as well.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. So how can people access the materials on the ILO website? You've sold us, you've convinced us, and we all want to get on there. So what should we do?
People can visit ILO's website at aila.utexas.org to browse, search, and read the catalog records in English or Spanish. But users have to register for a free account and log in to gain access to the media files. During the registration process, users must agree to the conditions of use of archived resources, and this includes, among other things, the expectation that the user will be respectful of the languages, cultures, and peoples represented in the archive, and that the media files may not be used for commercial purposes of any kind.
Easy access to these materials is fundamentally important to ILO. Since our collections are online, many of the barriers that have historically kept indigenous peoples and non-academics from accessing archival collections are just not present. However, not all materials in our collections are publicly accessible. Visitors to our site may find materials that have been restricted for one reason or another. In some cases, this may be due to a temporary embargo required by a publisher, but in other cases, these files are restricted due to the wishes of the people represented, or because the contents of the materials are culturally or personally sensitive. This is the case only for a small amount of the materials in ILO. Most of our materials are publicly accessible to any ILO user. We've put links to the FAQs about access levels and terms in the show notes.
Perfect. And so I just want to emphasize a couple of points that you two just made. This is a free resource that anyone can access. And at the same time, it's a very culturally sensitive resource that takes into consideration the fact that some materials, some samples should not be accessible for everyone in the world. So I think those are two very responsible principles that guide some of the work that you do. Do you have any future projects or events that we should be on the lookout for?
Our collections are always growing. We just finished a large multi-year project that expanded or created 8 collections from Highland, Ecuador, and the Northwest Amazon region along the Colombia-Brazil border. And in just the past year, there have been smaller new collections added for the Mayan languages Chol and Popti in Mexico and Guatemala, Ga'apur in Brazil, and several languages of Peru and Bolivia, Aymara, Quechua, Hakaru, and Cholón.
Also, we're revising our OER, Archiving for the Future, based on feedback that we've gotten from course users so far. We want to make the course useful for ILA's target audience in Latin America. So to that end, we've already translated almost all of the associated videos into Spanish and 3 of them into Portuguese, but the course manual itself still needs to be translated into both languages, which we plan to do as resources allow. However, I want to point out that since the course is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license, anyone is welcome to make a translation into any language they choose, and we are happy to collaborate to do that.
Yeah, wonderful. So there you go, folks. There's an opportunity to collaborate and participate. And that brings us to the conclusion of our podcast today. I want to give a heartfelt thanks to Dr. Susan Kung and Dr. Ryan Sullivan for their knowledge and sharing what they do every day with us. I, for one, feel much smarter and more knowledgeable about your work and continue to support it wholeheartedly. So thank you very much to the audience for listening to another episode of Benson at 100, and we'll see you next time.
And thank you, Dr. Arbino, for inviting us to talk.
Uh-oh.
I know. Thank you so much for having us here, Daniel.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The Benson at 100 is a production of Lilas Benson Latin American Studies and Collections at the University of Texas at Austin. To see relevant images and links for today's discussion, as well as to support the Benson Centennial, visit benson100.org. Music for this podcast was composed by Ola Ola. Thanks for tuning in.